Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 117, where we will examine an important work on economic sociology by Marion Fourcade, titled Sense and Sensibility, Economic Valuation and the Nature of Nature, published in the American Journal of Sociology in 2011. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Hi, this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
This is Sarah calling from Brighton in England.
And this is Greta calling from the beautiful town of Dordrecht in the Netherlands. And today, Georg Rillinger will be joining us. Georg is an assistant professor of technological innovation, entrepreneurship, and strategic management at the MIT Sloan School of Management. He's also a collaborator of mine and a good friend, and I'm very happy to have him joining us as a guest to today's episode.
Thank you so much. So this is Georg calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Hey, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself?
All right. Okay. So I'm a trained economic sociologist. I got my PhD in 2020 from the University of Chicago, and I work in a management school. So I'm basically straddling the world of economic sociology and OMT research. And in my work, I'm basically interested in technocratic projects of control and vision. So I'm interested in people that are building, designing, trying to control platform markets of various kinds. And I'm interested in the question whether the, like, basically, what is the relationship between the values, ideas, and goals of these designers and the social conditions under which they try to realize them? And then what makes it difficult to get markets that perform as these technocratic projects imagine them to function?
Okay, thank you. And that sort of aligns very closely with the article that you selected for us to read this month. This is Marion Fourcade's Sense and Sensibility, Economic Valuation and the Nature of Nature. And this is going into a thread that we have not followed in this program yet, economic sociology and the meaning of valuation. And Georg, since you chose the article, why don't you go ahead and clue us in as to why you chose it, and then we'll get started.
All right. Okay. So this paper is basically a study on how we create monetary value for intangible things that don't have a value. It like compares these oil spills and is interested in the question of how did the courts decide what the value of this unspoiled nature should be that people should be compensated for. And we'll talk about the content of the paper as we go along. But the reason why, or one of the reasons why I chose it, was that it is an early version, basically, of a type of inquiry that has become much more important in recent years. And what she's essentially doing is she's showing how the political, cultural, and legal context shapes the technologies of quantification that we use to make things measurable, in this case, in terms of money. And so I think that she was very important in establishing that we should think about these technologies that are used to, you know, so basically inside organizations and inside political processes, we often reach for tools that allow us to put a number on things that are qualitatively different to make them commensurable with each other. And oftentimes we think about these technologies as kind of detached from their context of production. And so she was one of the persons that showed, no, like if you want to understand how these technologies operate and like why there's variation in the use of these technologies, you really have to look at the political, historical, and legal context within which they were conceived and in which they are applied. And so this focus on the design and underlying cultural logic of technologies of quantification is, I think, a really big strength of this article and was way before its time. And so I think it anticipates lines of research in both management theory and in economic sociology that are really starting to take off now. And so maybe I'll say a little bit more about Marion Fourcade. She is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, in the sociology department, preeminent economic sociologist and who has written extensively about the relationship between economic knowledge and processes of quantification in society. And so she has written a really important book about the profession of economics and how it developed in France and the US and England, I think. And she has recently published a book called The Ordinal Society with Kieran Healy, which is about the proliferation of techniques of quantification in all areas of life, but particularly the platform economy and like how techniques of quantification organize social life in the platform economy. It's called The Ordinal Society. Yeah, I think that her research is very timely. She's a central figure in economic sociology, and she speaks to an issue that is relevant across fields. And so I think that is like the reason why I chose this article.
Now, the subject of valuation in this particular article is on nature. Just kind of getting into the article itself, I guess you can kind of think of it in at least two parts. The first part being the exploration of how value of intangible things, peculiar objects is one of the terms used, is done, those processes. And then the other part is to use the case studies of a comparative analysis, which is between US and France with respect to their responses to different oil spills. The US having its episode and the French having a couple of episodes, which were sort of like two in a series of spills that had happened over the course of a decade. And then as the cases wind their way through the court systems, where did the numbers come from that decided how much damages and for what? That's kind of the question that Fourcade is asking. You know, where did those numbers come from? That kind of sets up a much broader research agenda. So that's what kind of struck me, was because this is sort of the first time looking at the study of valuation of intangible things, which is something that in my line of work, which is heavily military, heavily government, we're dealing with a lot of intangible things. So very excited to get into the discussion.
Well, without going through too many layers of it, I think another piece of classical sociology, if we go completely into the sociology end of the discussion, it reminds me of a piece that we learned from Durkheim that says, we learn what society considers sacred by identifying what it considers profane. So by looking at the reactions to transgressions, to norm violations, what gets punished, what gets identified, we learn, therefore, what it values. And I always teach that sometimes in a strategy implementation class, sometimes in a negotiations class, but it is all about trying to identify what individuals and the collective values. And I thought that was something that was very strongly developed in this article, was not that it came at us with a hammer that you must value nature or that you must value public goods. It wasn't a sort of Eleanor Ostrom idea that we all have a responsibility to the collective or to solve the Leviathan. It wasn't one of those moral philosophy approaches. It came at it from the other direction, this Durkheim direction of, let's look at what happens when the absolute worst occurs and try and decide what we can save, what we value, what we need to restore. And it goes down an avenue because of the legal framework to talk about different types of justice, which is something else that I also have a background in, the difference between retributive and restorative justice, you know. And so I thought that was really interesting. And I mean, I don't have the articles under my thumb, as I'm sure Georg and Greta do, but I don't actually think she mentioned that piece of classicism, that piece of classical sociology there. And to me, that was the most natural link.
Durkheim, you mean?
The sacred and the profane, yeah. I didn't remember the sacred and the profane in the article.
It's a little bit buried in the article, but like she does talk about it. And actually, it's a bit implicit, but it is strongly there. And it like is even in the puzzle that the paper has, right? Because what she starts out with is this basic insight that in France, nature is much less valuable than in America, right? Like, so when the court settled, even though the oil spill in France was much, much larger and much more devastating to the nature there than the Exxon oil spill in Alaska, the price that was ultimately awarded, like the monetary value that was assigned, was much lower in France than it was in the US, right? And so, like, you know, this kind of could strike us as puzzling because we wouldn't normally see the America as like anti-business, right? Like usually we would think, okay, so America is pro-business and France probably anti-business, and there's all this like rich tradition and so on. So how do we make sense of that? That's kind of the puzzle, right? Like this counterintuitive empirical result that we see here. But like as she develops the argument, she actually comes to the point that she says, you know, the reason why we think that sometimes that we have this intuition is that we think that by assigning a monetary value to things like nature, we're diminishing it, we're profanizing it, making it more profane, right? Like we're diminishing its sacralized character. But she says that, like, quite to the contrary, and following a different definition of Durkheim, the act of assigning a value to nature as like abstract notion of nature, as unspoiled nature, as something that can be enjoyed even without using it, just by its sheer existence can be enjoyed by the American public. And by putting a monetary value on that, it surrounds the object with a number of prohibitions that, like, you know, basically are enforced by imposing these punishments when you spoil the nature, and thereby sacralize it even more. So the idea is that, like, quite to the contrary, what we would expect, monetization actually helps to sacralize this thing because it makes it legible in the eyes of the law and creates and like puts it apart as something that needs to be specially protected, right? And so she shows it's exactly opposite of what we would normally expect, but follows quite closely from this like Durkheimian definition of the difference between the sacred and the profane. So yeah, I think that was like a really good observation.
And really contextualized by the religious historical contextual background of where they are. So she makes a really good point about Catholic originating countries versus Protestant traditions and goes beyond just the sort of Calvinist work ethic. So the key point that in that small section in the introduction was that because Catholicism believes in the inherent worth of an individual as a human life, independent of whether it's a rich life or a poor life, you know, that it's easier, you can't take it with you idea. Therefore, money isn't as motivating. So therefore, punishment by money would not be as demotivating. You have to otherwise enshrine protection and demonstrate what you value. Whereas the rest of the sort of Protestant-based world does believe in a work ethic and a meritocracy and an accumulation of wealth that can then buy you a change in status, which is, of course, my interest in economic sociology and work theory, as listeners will have known from our other episodes. So it buys you this change in status, and therefore it's directly relevant to hit somebody in their pocketbook, right? To make a punishment that is financial, to make a value that is financial, and therefore make a character judgment as well. And I thought that was a really good way of showing us that, look, even religion is a societal, historical, contextual choice, and a guiding factor. We know how much religion leads to our secular law, and certainly in different legal frameworks around the world, that's closer and farther apart in the coupling. But it's independent of the legal framework when you then have to make a moral judgment, which in turn becomes potentially an economic judgment. It still has these long tentacles. And it was just a small part of the introduction, but it was such a light bulb moment in this article. It makes so much more sense when you think about where the original values come from that start guiding these decisions, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like I totally agree. I think one of the great strengths of the article, one of the reasons why I chose it, is exactly that. She shows really nicely how this like long historical legacy, this cultural legacy of Catholicism and feudalism in France and Protestantism and a kind of the new world in America imbue the technologies that are ultimately used to create the value of nature, right? And so I think this contextualization, this kind of deneutralizing of these technologies, like that's a theme that's really valuable and that could, I think, even more valuably kind of inform contemporary research on how technologies of quantification affect distributional outcomes of interests across a variety of different domains.
Absolutely. And I think what I liked about it is that it does that in kind of counterintuitive ways, as you already referred to, Georg, in the beginning. And perhaps for the audience, it would be good, before we dive into the paper more deeply, to just set up some of the basic data points. So the paper is basically a comparative analysis between broadly two oil spills, one happening in France in 1978 and the other one happening about a decade later in Alaska in the United States. So the France one is the Moco Cadiz case, and the American case is Exxon Valdez. And it looks at how big were these oil spills actually. And the Moco Cadiz case was 227,000 tons of oil that was spilled. It was one of the largest oil spills that ever happened. The one in Alaska, the Exxon Valdez case, was 30,000 tons, so it was much smaller. But what is surprising is that in terms of how the case was trialed and the settlements or the judgments that were achieved is that in the French case, there was 61 million in terms of actual damages that they asked the oil company to pay. Whereas in the case of Exxon Valdez, it was over $1 billion. So this was massively different in these two cases and not in accordance with the amount of oil that was actually spilled. So then they look at, okay, what happened? And what I really liked about the paper is how it's set up. Kind of the three-part structure, and that's also discussed in the abstract. So quickly going to the abstract now, that a full-blown sociology of economic valuation, because that's what it's about. How do you attribute economic value to something that is inherently intangible? You have to answer three questions, which is the why, the how, and the then what. And I really like that setup, which is also kind of a more processual analysis that she lays out in the paper. And so the why refers to this general place of money as a metric of worth. So why do you value the worth in terms of economic measures? The how is a specific technique. So that's where the whole sociology of quantification that has really picked up as we move towards more digital spaces comes in. And then what? And that's the feedback loop. What happens? What are the consequences when this is implemented? I really enjoyed reading like this very rich narrative of the social construction of economic value that Marion Fourcade is laying out in this paper.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it was a beautiful summary. And what she does really well is she basically shows how there is this imbrication between the cultural, political, and legal that then manifests in the kind of struggle between the experts and the various stakeholders and the judges in the court setting of how exactly this valuation process is supposed to take place. Right. And so I think that even though the paper is based on data from these court cases themselves and interviews with experts, like it draws a much, much broader analytical lens that brings in this like much broader socio-technical context into the courtroom and shows how it shapes these different proceedings. And so in that, yeah, I think in that way, it's really masterfully done.
Yeah, because just the topic itself, the nature of nature, part of the title, I mean, we're talking about valuation, but the valuation of what is an important part of that question that she raises. What exactly are we talking about? The meaning of the term nature or what is being valued is open to interpretation. And there's a whole sociology associated with how you actually do that. She followed the same three steps. You know, why value nature? How do you value nature? And what are the consequences of it that drove ultimately the judgments in these particular cases, but also more broadly, the understanding of nature when it comes to political processes in general, the political legitimacy. She has a whole section about the rise of cost-benefit analysis and cost-benefit analysis being one tool to answer those questions. Value, for what purpose, and what do we perceive to be harm to that value, and therefore what would be the recompense, which leads directly into the discussion about the judgments, the legal framework, and the measuring rod of money. She gets into how, in some circumstances, the value of money as a way of achieving equality or equitability across a society, which drives then how it's used, you know, for what purpose do you use it as a punitive, or like in the legal system, use it for punitive purposes as opposed to just simply repairing a debt or repairing harm. You know, again, this is all in the setup. This is all laying down the framework for how to evaluate the cases. Later on, we'll get into where this framework can be used in other, you know, for other settings of things that are intangible. It is a very brief, easy to read, and pretty strongly convincing in my mind. I could see exactly where she's going with setting up all of this context so that when we get into the cases, it does become a bit more eye-opening because she uses this framework to ask the right questions. Why did you have such a disparate judgment done given the different scales of the disasters? It's because of the different ways in which the two nations attach value to what is a rather amorphous nature as a thing.
Yeah, exactly. Like there is, like, I think one of the main things that she says is that the very thing that we're talking about, namely nature, is conceptualized differently in the different countries, and that it has to do with these different cultural backgrounds, right? Like, so Sarah already talked about the difference between Protestantism and more Catholic foundations in France and in America. But then the other part is also that the rise of cost-benefit analysis in America was closely tied to the deep suspicion in government and this idea that government should be able to justify its choices in ways that are publicly intelligible, right? And so this like push for more rational means of justifying different policies is born out of this American skepticism of an overly powerful government, which goes all the way back to their constitution. Whereas in France, where you have this like more centralized technocratic government with a highly trained technical elite that is mathematically gifted and so on, preserved much more a kind of a legitimate discretion in making decisions that didn't anchor these techniques of quantification so strongly in the way that the government proceeds. And anyways, I thought that was really interesting because usually when we talk about techniques of quantification and how they're used to control populations, we think about their negative effects, right? Like I would say that the sociology of quantification is mainly concerned with how the imposition of quantitative tools creates distributional inequities. But in this case, the cost-benefit analysis, which has also had like many negative effects, was actually born out of a desire for more oversight of government and enhancing transparency for the public and so on. And so I think that the way that she draws out this history and shows its consequences for the kind of ease with which the American case reached for the construction of a monetary value for the unspoiled nature, whereas this was much more contentious and constrained in France and therefore then led to much lower payments, is really interesting.
But she also explains another difference that we need for this audience and for our reading about, which is the core difference between an economist and a sociologist, right? And how economic sociology is in the middle. And the key thing there is that an economist needs to know how much something is worth because he needs to know what he can exchange it for, right? It's about how we put a monetary value first on commodities and then on at a market, and then with the commodities that are transformed into something else through effort, and then we put another value on that, and how do we trade? So that's why an economist needs to know what the value is, right? But then when she talks about the extent of the national park system and the age of it, which are just over 150 years old in the US, not even 100 years old in France, right? So there's a big difference already. Every single time that we have to put a value on it, it says, well, this is the size of the land and the value of the land is X. But it can't possibly be an economist's valuation because it can never be sold. It's a public institution being guarded by the government with certain access rights, and then there's light rights over it and fresh air rights and water rights, but it's never ever going to be sold. You know, the nation of Canada is never going to take Grand Teton National Park for a certain price. So for a pure economist, this is a problem, right? Because there is no market and there is no security and there is no discussion and any other mechanisms that you have. But when you take a social aspect to it, which she also breaks down and says, hang on a minute, sociologists, you're not perfect in a way in the discussion, but a social value to it being the availability of land, fresh air, fresh water, fresh sunshine, especially she talks about for urban dwellers in the Industrial Revolution, access to that, as well as what other things about preserving nature says about us as a person. So the moral value of it is involved. And that is a valuation that needs to have a number because of these other systems, because of tort law, because of insurance, because of using it as collateral. I mean, there are instances, I'm sure Tom can tell us about this, especially we had an episode on nuclear activity and nuclear waste and where is a safe place away from everything else natural to store nuclear waste and how they value the distance from a nuclear storage facility because of nature. And those all have to be non-economic values. They might have a number on them, but they're not purely economic because they will never be spent and there's never a market. And so she talks about that in the article and even breaking down some of the laws. There's a part where she talks about the protection of the sea in France and a way that the French break up res communis, which is something that belongs to the community and cannot be appropriated, and res nullus, which doesn't belong to anyone but can be appropriated. And so again, she's talking about the difference between the sea there, the water, and the sea life that lives in the water, so the fish and the water separately. Again, they're not talking about selling the water. They're not talking about changing the borders of the country or really even insuring the water against damage, which are all economic functions. But there has to be this way of measuring and calculating. And so enter the sociologists, right? Or enter the managers.
Well, yeah, no, it's very, like, I mean, I think you're putting your finger on the most interesting part of the article. At least that's what I thought was the most interesting part. The question of, like, how do you actually move from a sense that something is valuable, but there's no market for it, to a monetary value, right? Like, how can you define an exchange value when there is no market? And the interesting thing is that the experts that were brought in to make this determination differed, right? In the French case, they brought in biologists and ecologists. And in the American case, they brought in these, oh, by the way, like both trials happened in America. It was just that the plaintiffs were different ones. In one case, French rural communities, and in the other, the American state. But like in the American case, they brought in these economists, right? And so they applied this method called contingent valuation, which is a way to kind of get around this problem that there is no market. And it's doing it brilliantly by stipulating a hypothetical market, right? And so the basic idea in economics is that you can infer the value of a price from the revealed preferences of individuals that make a purchase, right? Like, so if you purchase something at a given price, that was your preference for the thing, you've revealed the value of the thing. And so they move from that to the idea of stated preference, where they basically send out a survey and ask people what they think the value of unspoiled nature should be, given that there is danger of companies like ExxonMobil spoiling it, right? And so what they would pay for that. And then they asked, interestingly, not people that were affected by the oil spill, but they asked people all over the country in a representative survey, I think in the southern 48 states, and basically asked them, okay, so like fill out the survey. And then they just multiplied that by 92 American households, and they ended up with 2.5 billion or something like that, of which were awarded 1 billion, right? And so what they did, and which they do all the time now, and which is what I study, is they basically created a market where there was none before, and came up with basically a framework within which people could put a monetary value on the thing. They basically constructed an artificial demand curve, thereby made it look like the democratic public had established its preferences in a market. And so, I mean, like, this thing was super contentious, and ExxonMobil actually hired its own economic experts and even put on a conference and published a book to kind of discredit this method. And so there was like a huge debate in economics around the validity of moving from revealed to stated preferences and all the different methodological problems associated with that, that was triggered by this case, right? And so, like, this is another thing that's really interesting about this paper. It shows how closely the technologies of economists, the quantification technologies of economists, and the very notion of a market that can generate a price is connected to the like legal political structure of the US, right? And you can see that really nicely in the contrast to the French case, where what happened was that basically, because nature is always kind of perceived to be the nature that the rural communities use, right? Like, so it's understood in terms of rural communities' enjoyment of it, they try to basically just calculate the lost biomass and then went to the next best thing in the market that had a prize, and then just extrapolated that prize from like existing markets to this lost biomass that could have been enjoyed by the people that ordinarily use nature. And that led to a much, much more concrete and much lower valuation than in the US, right? And so the paper shows why it was that in France, they would go with the biologists and this like very use-based, analogy-based view of how to price nature. Whereas in America, they constructed these or could construct these hypothetical market in which you could express your preference for unspoiled nature as like a fictional commodity. So yeah, these technologies and how they're imbued with the cultural background of the two nations is the core strength of this paper, and a really just a fascinating demonstration of how contingent and like contested the notion of a market as a calculation device really is.
I think you're really hitting the core of the paper here, Georg. And I especially like the example of how they evaluated the laws of snails in the water by looking at how snails sold in the commercial market. But that aside, I think it points to something else, and that is that in the French case, actually the reference that the biologists made to infer the value of biomass lost to a real market was way more contested and rejected by the judge than the imaginary constructed market of the economists. And perhaps, you know, we've also talked about this in other episodes, you know, what is the knowledge of a profession worth? And their ways of evaluating things or coming up with metrics. And in the end, even though the system of the biologists was more real world, it got rejected several times. And also the compensation was much lower compared to the actual thing. And that Fourcade brings up is, how do we define nature? Is it actual nature, or is it the imaginary of having the ability to access it that's valued?
That's a really good point.
Profound.
Yeah, no, very, very good. And like, and who has the power to define it, right? And this is a really, really good point.
And what I'd also add is that remembering the Exxon Valdez, when that judgment came down, there were also, you know, as large as it was for its time, I remember very clearly how much it was decried as not being enough. It sort of highlights the extent to which in the United States, the punitive aspect is really central to the way we think about these proceedings. And it's almost not so much about the value of nature alone, it's the value of imposing a punishment, I suppose, because it's sort of repeated in the British Petroleum oil spill in, was it 2010 or 2011, I think, in the Gulf, where because the memory of the Exxon Valdez was still very, very strong, much as it was in the French case, because that spill was the fourth in a series of spills over 10 years that had really gotten a lot of people in that region very, very upset. By the time we get to the British Petroleum case, the media, the public outcry, the pictures of oil-soaked birds and the devastation on the coast just sort of drove the conversation about how bad a situation this is, how unacceptable it is. And I think fueled sort of a demand for even harsher action. So, you know, kind of getting into the then what part of Fourcade's model here, once you establish that if this is the value such that we're going to punish a corporation this much for an act, regardless of whether or not it was accidental or what have you, when we have the next episode, now that there's the punitive side and the meta punitive side, you're going to get hit for doing this again. You, the oil industry, are going to get hit for doing this again, and worse, because you should have learned from the previous episode, which I think has kind of compounds or balloons the punitive side of the discussion. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that part, like, I mean, it's a little bit less prevalent in the paper, this question of to what extent is this punitive, to what extent is it deterrence, to what extent is it like a technicality. But she does mention a little bit that the American system, because of its reliance on jurors, the jury trial, and the fact that most American juries are instinctively retributionists, right? Like they basically try to impose a punishment that is large enough to deter and to make up for the moral violation that has occurred, that this moral bent tends to be ingrained in the American system, whereas in the French system, things are a little bit more practical. It's about restoring lost use value, right? Like the reference is essentially, what money do we need to fix the problem? That's the reference category. And so there are like different moral valences embedded in the two legal systems that also then influence what technical tools you can use to establish the specific value. In the French case, lower than in the American case.
We have this in other areas than nature. And again, American tort law really helps understand here, because we have this in healthcare, and the definitely broken but does have a use American malpractice and you know, medical insurance and legislative system. There, what has developed, for any of our listeners who aren't aware, is a concept of a QALY. It's called a QALY. Which stands for Quality Adjusted Life Year. This is a tool from actuarial science that if there needs to be a medical malpractice award or a physical bodily damages award, like in a car accident, for example, it goes beyond restoring loss of earnings. It goes beyond the very famous pain and suffering, and it goes beyond deterrent punishment for punitive damages. It's another piece that says, well, without this incident or this point of judgment occurring, what would have been the remaining life years of this person in quality? So in full or reasonable health, in full contribution to the economy, and then after retirement, let's say, in a declined contribution to the economy and full contribution to society. And they're agreed upon models that we use here, weightings for gender and age, weightings for profession, as Greta already raised, you know, weightings for current activity or not. Do you have children to raise or not? And those things are all built through case law out of the American legal system. But just like our initial discussion on the sacred and the profane, that value shows us almost essentially the value of a human life. And, you know, there are other scholars who have studied other broken or dark markets, for example, in organ transplants. That's a common one that economists play with. And then we also talk in moral philosophy and we talk in sociology. And, you know, at present, no one has a live market for human organs. And in general, I think we have international agreements that we should not, and we will prevent wherever we can. But on paper, you can make a market, right? You can make these kinds of adjustments for the value of life through a QALY type system. And again, I was expecting that she would raise that as an example, almost as to say, well, we have this for human life. We should have this for natural life. We should have this for the sea life that was lost in Northern Brittany. We should have this for the ducks and the birds and the land mammals that lost this in Alaska. We should have this for the quality of water. We should have, and I was really expecting the paper to get there. But then of course that is more of a pure economic and actuarial approach to it and less about a society, right? Because the societal approach would say, no, we don't want to put a dollar value on these things, because we can't, because they're never to be exchanged, they're never to be touched, they're to be cherished but not valued monetarily like that. And therefore, I think that's a piece that wasn't in here that would have potentially, you know, extended an olive branch to our economics brothers and sisters a bit, would be to use that mechanism to come to some common ground.
Yeah, I mean, that is a good point. The interesting thing with organs in particular is that there is a really famous market for organ donations, but it doesn't use money. And so exactly like you were saying, right? Like, because these are considered reprehensible exchanges, similarly with school positions, or there are a couple of other objects or commodities that are like things that we don't like to consider as commodities. And I mean, like, there's a long tradition in that sociological research that shows how the boundaries of what is considered to be reprehensible exchange and what is considered to be okay for exchange are shifting, going back to Vivian Zelitzer and so on, and her work in the late 70s, right? Like, it's a long, long line of that. But economists have basically found a way around that. So what they're doing is they're basically saying, look, organ donations, for example, is mostly an allocation problem, right? Like, there's a scarce thing that is like, let's say, a kidney. There's a lot of demand. And the current system that we have, namely waiting lists, is inefficient in the allocation of these organs, considering more than just efficiency, right? Like, you can have a variety of moral criteria by which there would be a better allocation of organs to organ donors to patients. And so Alvin Roth, you know, who basically popularized market design, came up with a solution that is kind of like an auction for organ donations, but it works without real money. It basically just works with stated preferences and like some characteristics of the patients, and then identifies the longest chains essentially of related donations that optimizes the number of exchanges that take place in the system that also maximize quality of life, right? And so economists have entered this space and have just kind of develop markets that work without money.
But then extend the thought experiment. Would you then be able to apply that kind of Roth chain to nature and to the different actors and non-human actors and human actors involved in the different cases that she brings up? You know, if we had the ability to ask the author right here, what do we think, at least this writing, that maybe the new book, you know, it takes a change, and maybe the number of incidents that have happened since take the change. Like we say, we do reserve the right to update our preferences and update our knowledge. But based on the article as it is in 2011, do we think that that kind of Roth chain would work for nature and the different actors who are wronged with these kinds of incidents?
I don't think that Foucault has a normative position either way, right? Like, she stays away from that. Her question is just her question is just an empirical question of how do we explain that there is these like radically different valuation regimes for comparable cases in the same legal system, namely the US courts, right? And so that's her task. Like, I don't think that she has a particularly strong view about like what is better or where markets should be applied or shouldn't be applied, right? Like, it's just an examination of like what happens when they do and how do we make it work? Like, how is it possible that this type of valuation takes place? But I think that like if you talk to market designers, they can basically translate any distributional problem. One of the things that is like part of my own work now, which goes away a little bit from what Marianne Foucault is saying, but shows up in her more recent book, is this idea that market designers view markets as search algorithms that solve optimization problems, right? Like, so the idea is that a market is basically just an algorithm that identifies an optimal distribution of objects to a group of consumers. You can formulate almost any problem where you have like a scarce resource or commodity or something that isn't yet a commodity that needs to be allocated to a group of recipients as like such an optimization problem. And then market designers come up with the kind of mechanisms to facilitate this trade, right? And you can see this everywhere. Like, we have now markets where pollution is priced, right? Like, pollution is turned into a commodity and sold as emission certificates. Or you have electricity is like another case that I've studied extensively, which is essentially something, it's a force that moves at the speed of light through a system of interconnected flows. And so like economists have managed to turn that into a discrete commodity that can be priced and paid and so on and so on. So I would say that the economic technologies that market designers have developed and that were like, you know, that she's talking about as where, you know, she's talking about contingent valuation as like one technology, but there are many others. They're like boundaryless. As soon as you have an allocation problem, you can translate it into a problem that can be solved with a kind of market mechanism of sorts.
Let me ask a question, because I can see two different kinds of punitive outcomes, like going back to the then what. You know, you sort of have the punitive outcome to a company that did something wrong, which obviously is sort of transactional. But then you also have the political then what, which is to say of people mobilizing to prevent further exploitation of the wilderness. So you think about, and I saw this when I was in Europe as well, where you have active efforts to stop further development of or expansion of particular technologies or markets in order to prevent the possible future harm to the environment, such as we're going to stop the digging of the fast train system that's going to go underneath the city of Stuttgart, or we want to stop the Alaskan pipeline. I think she even mentioned the Alaskan pipeline in this article. It's a valuation of a different sort, I suppose, where the outcome of trying to stop a market is prized. I'm not sure I'm explaining myself well. So what I mean?
So it's definitely true that efforts of this type of economization, right? Like basically solving social problems through markets, like that is definitely something that is being contested. I think this article that we read, like in some ways it can be understood as an argument against marketization when you think about it like this. Like oftentimes people say that markets can be used to solve all kinds of collective problems, right? Like, you know, from in California, they're now debating developing markets for water, which is something that's heavily contested. That's something that I can think of where like the application of economic technology, like the one that Marion Foucault is talking about, is being contested by the public and like quite heavily contested, right? You can think of this paper as saying these technologies are not neutral. They promise to solve the problem in a way that balances all interests equally. And that's just basically just like transform, like just this take preferences that politicians give down for how this problem should solve. And then are just a neutral technical solution. That's kind of what economists that work in this space and software engineers and operations researchers and so on, what they sometimes claim. And I think you can read Marion Foucault's paper as saying, no, 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 these technologies are highly socially, culturally, politically contingent artifacts that express the moral valences of the people that created them, of the nations that created them, right? And so you can think about that as like this contextualization as a critique against this, like the statement that experts often make that their methods are objective and neutral and therefore stand above the fray of democratic discourse, right? And so she's pulling it back into the political discourse and saying, no, 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 these technologies are the outcome of complex political contestations that take place on a cultural level, institutional level, and even organizational level. And so that needs to be considered. And so therefore, there are not inherently more objective or neutral than alternative ways of expressing worth.
Yeah, there are actually two things that stood out for me in this regard. And one of them being what role the state takes when there is an environmental disaster happening, like an oil spill. And for instance, what stood out for me is that state of Alaska got $35 million of funding to do investigation of what the environmental impact of this oil spill was. And when you look at the French case, there was no money. And actually, the local communes that were affected were at the brink of bankruptcy to cover the expenses related to the court case, to the investigations. So the amount of money that the state actually provides to actually investigate and deal with the court case was vastly different. And I saw the role that the state took much broader in these cases. But let me move on to the second part, and that is like, who can actually claim compensation for nature being destroyed? That was also a very big difference. And there's a very nice table in the paper for the people that are going to look up the paper. I wish it was at the beginning of the paper, but it is at the end on page 7070, table 3 with a summary of the argument. Who speaks in the name of nature? And in the Exxon Valdez case, it's the state, federal government speaking in the name of the individuals that make up the U.S. public. It's the U.S. public. And in the French case, Amoco Cadiz, it's organizations with a specific custodian role, local populations, collectives, such as regions, towns, associations. So it was a very different definition. And I also felt like, you know, you do see shining through this, especially the French case, the role of French bureaucracy a little bit, like definitions and rules and what you already pointed out, Sarah, like these two different French concepts that I don't know the words anymore. But bringing these concepts and rules into being really have consequences. And you see it very clearly in this case.
Yeah, I think, I mean, like that's, you put it perfectly. Like this is the second really important point, right? Because, and it's like, I think one of the weaknesses of the paper is that it is not able to fully pull those two things apart, right? Because it turns out that because in France, no one owns nature, right? It's this res nullius. lots of people can make different claims on whether they have been harmed in their appropriation of nature. Whereas in America, the government owns all land, like it's a public trust. And so therefore, like, maintains and protects it at behest of the public is kind of the idea, right? And so very different ideas of ownership, just like you were saying. And so, but that meant that, like, in the US case, you had like one very powerful player that was fighting for the recompensation, right? Or for the punitive damages. And in the other case, you had this complex configuration of actors that were fighting against each other. These communes weren't just suing the oil company, AMCO, but they were also suing the French government, right? And there was like, because the government had violated its duty to protect their claim in the nature, right? And so there was this way in which there was a fragmentation of judicial position and a fragmentation of the financial power to do the research that was necessary to demonstrate the claim. And so in the end, the French case was pretty much settled at like, not settled, but like it was awarded like way below the intended sums, precisely because the judge basically contested the ability of the plaintiffs to even claim the violation of nature for themselves. And so that I 100% agree that that is like another branch of the argument that is very important, and it is also rooted in the different cultural understandings of what nature is in France and in the US.
Yeah, and it also shows the organizational aspect of it. You need resources and you need organizational structure to prepare for such cases. And when there are too many parties, it's a lot of coordination that needs to happen that doesn't come to the benefit of the final result you can in terms of what evidence you can deliver in court. You know, if we are in an environment now where there are certain elections, you know, this is also true for other big undertakings, not just in resolving nature disasters like oil spills, but it does show that organization is important, and that was vastly different in these two cases.
Absolutely. And to your point that expertise matters, right? Like that's the other thing that the state of the US could basically draw from the core of economics and bring the most legitimized experts to basically defend this idea that this contingent valuation method was a legitimate way of measuring this. Whereas the French experts had these marine biologists that didn't have any particular credibility as experts who could speak to the monetary value of nature, right? Like they could assess the damage, but they couldn't actually put a price on it. And so their expertise was discounted. And so the organizational and the kind of jurisdictional professional side of this thing are really, really important, like whose expertise counts.
So I think if we use those three, if we use bureaucracy, coordination, and expertise, I think we now have a bridge to explaining how economic sociology is connected to organization theory.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.